This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Ajamu Baraka, U.S. vice presidential candidate for the Green Party.
The party is getting a lot of attention, and as the election winds down, increasing support.
We'll talk to George Christian, one of the members of the so-called Connecticut Four, brave librarians who stood up against a national security letter.
When Mr. Christian took George Orwell's book 1984 off the shelf, he took its warning to heart.
The largest gang raid in New York City history has disturbing racial and gentrification implications, as young persons have been arrested just by virtue of who they associate with.
120 young, mostly African-American men were swept up and imprisoned in what has dangerous ramifications for the rest of the country.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We speak today with Ajamu Baraka, the vice presidential candidate of the Green Party and the running mate of presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein. Chicago-born 63-year-old Baraka is a human rights defender whose experience spans three decades of domestic and international education and activism. He's a veteran grassroots organizer whose roots are in the Black Liberation Movement and the anti-apartheid and Central American solidarity struggles. Ajamu Baraka is a veteran grassroots organizer who came out of the Black Liberation Movement and the anti-apartheid and Central American solidarity struggles. He writes for Black Agenda Report, sits on the board of directors of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies.
Ajamu Baraka, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start by telling our audience, what does the Green Party stand for and why is it different?
Well, the Green Party, of course, has a long history in protecting and being committed to advancing the interests of human beings in relationship to the environment. But it also is a party that is fundamentally committed to the notions of social justice and social change. We believe in that we can advance progressive politics using nonviolence. We believe that it's important that we put people and planet over profits. So this is just some of the core beliefs of the Green Party. That's also reflected in this campaign that we are currently running here in 2016. We believe that we represent the only alternative to the two major elite parties. We believe that we're the only party that has a platform that reflects those core values of social justice, with racial justice, protection for the environment, addressing in a serious way the issue of the climate crisis that we currently find ourselves in, advancing a notion of peace that suggests that the U.S. state should not be involved in destabilizing legitimate sovereign nations around the world, undermining democratic countries, not engaging in the kind of warmongering that we see coming from both of the parties. So these are the values that are reflected in our platforms. These are the positions that we are advancing in this current campaign.
And why are you running for vice president when you know you likely can't win?
Because we believe that it's important for us to build an alternative to the two parties that basically are representing the same elite interests. And that we believe that we can win, and we are winning, because anytime we have an opportunity to engage the people in critical discussion, anytime we have a chance to build a real alternative opposition to the two capitalist monopoly parties, we are, in fact, winning. I mean, it's fundamentally important for us to have some kind of oppositional presence. If one is going to participate in the electoral process, it makes no sense for us to completely surrender that space to the ruling elite. So building democracy and building real independent political power is always a winning proposition. So, you know, we have already won in many ways.
What do you tell people who say this time Clinton really is the lesser of two evils, given how monstrous Trump is? What's your response to that?
they have basically drunken the Kool-Aid, that they're not engaging in critical thought. That while we recognize that Trump represents very dark forces, we know that we're going to have Trumpism with us after November the 8th, because we had it before this campaign, that the politics of xenophobia and racism, of domination, have been a core element of the Republican agenda. But we also know that, you know, the political realignment taking place among the right, with significant elements moving from the Republican Party and moving over to the Democrats and the Clinton campaign, represents also a very serious threat. It represents, for the first time, I believe, since the crisis, really even before that, a consolidation, a unity, if you will, among the ruling elite. The ruling elite has been in disarray for quite some time, and the collapse in 2008 just intensified those contradictions among the various ruling factions. But there seems to be a consensus building in which they're going to, in fact, begin to support the Clinton thrust in ways that opposes a real threat to all of us who are concerned about the working class and poor people here in this country. So we say basically, you know, if one is serious, and we're talking primarily to so-called progressives in this country and radicals, and that if one is really serious about opposing the right, you have to look at how the various expressions of right-wing politics are now evolving. And we can't be too diverted in looking at the bombastic and bizarre comments coming from Donald Trump and miss the kind of threat that's taking place with this new political realignment and the kind of politics that this alignment suggests for all of us here in this country.
Well, that brings us to two questions. One is with respect to what Clinton and her military and security advisors have been talking about with respect to Syria, and secondly, the huge military buildup on the border of Russia. Have you had a chance to talk about those issues with your audiences?
Constantly, because we're the only ones that are talking about these issues related to the threat of more war in the so-called Middle East, and this reckless and dangerous rhetoric coming from the Clinton campaign regarding Russia. In fact, I'm going to tell you, we have picked up some momentum over the last couple of weeks. You know, normally, you know, third-party efforts tend to lose some steam in October as you get closer to the election date. So even when people kind of want to support a third party, then they get to the point where they are ready to hold their nose and vote for the lesser of two evils. But we have picked up some new momentum, and we think that that momentum is connected to the fact that, unlike during the Democratic Party nomination process, there was very little discussion at that time around U.S. foreign policy. So, you know, we weren't exposed to the real positions of Hillary Clinton. But coming out of the debate, so-called debate process, and in particular the second debate, where we saw for the first time the kind of dangerous positions that the Clinton campaign and Hillary Clinton herself hold vis-a-vis Russia, vis-a-vis the Syrian war, it seemed to promise that a Clinton administration would be committed to a continuation of the politics of domination coming out of the Bush and the Obama administration, and that part of that domination is a continued commitment to militarism and permanent war. And people seem to be tired of this of war and concerned about the implications of rising tensions with Russia in particular, you know, a nuclear power. And so as a consequence, people are understanding and coming to the conclusion that a vote for Hillary could in fact be a vote for war. And so we have seen in particular young people coming to the Green Party, so that you look at even the polls, we have not only held steady, we are starting to crop up in the polls. And the polls are not catching what's really under the radar here in this country. I mean, you know, so we see something very significant with that. And And I think that we are going to be in a position to engage in a healthy debate and healthy opposition to this move toward war on the part of the corporate Democrats.
Jamu, the United States recently granted Israel $38 billion for military defense over the next decade. Where do you stand on that issue?
We take a clear position that, one, that was specifically that was obscene. That's a reward for Israel to continue to deny the rights, the fundamental human rights to Palestinians, to support their settlement expansion policies, to continue to be the external U.S. fort in the Middle East. We are completely opposed to that. If we were able to win the election and seize nominal control of the executive, that we would have to tell and will tell Israel that there will be is a new date in terms of U.S.-Israeli relations. That basically we will no longer support their settlement policies. We will no longer support politics that make it impossible for this notion of a two-state solution to occur. We're no longer going to give them political cover in international arenas. So our position on Israel is quite clear. We're not going to, and me personally, and on this ticket, we're not going to continue to support the colonial project that we know as Israel.
Since the 2008 economic crash in the United States, we've spent some tens of trillions of dollars bailing out failing banks and corporations. What's your position on the success of these bailouts?
Well, the success of the bailout is pretty obvious for the banks, that the $16 trillion or so that they receive through various mechanisms, including quantitative easing, has resulted in their coffers being expanded and big bonuses and tremendous amounts of idle capital laying around. Some of them being used for, we see now these moves toward further acquisitions, consolidations of capital. We think it's been a boondoggle for them. For the rest of the people in the U.S. and globally, it's been continued austerity, continued and expanding misery and suffering, and it exposes the contradictions that have to be addressed by working class and poor people in this country and globally. That basically we can no longer tolerate the neoliberal order. Look, that is part of what's driving the support for Donald Trump. Support for Donald Trump, of course, isn't just those individuals who are white supremacists, white nationalists. I mean, those elements are there, and that's a very important part of right-wing populism. But, you know, there are also many people who have felt the consequences of global neoliberalism, and they have no way to understand why there's been such a deterioration in their lives. And so the simplistic analysis being offered to them by people like Donald Trump and other elements of the right, they tend to embrace. But one thing they have understood clearly, even though they don't draw the right kind of conclusions, is that these so-called free trade agreements have had a detrimental impact on their lives. They can see the consequences of these agreements in terms of enhancing the power and wealth of the transnational elite, and they're upset. So, you know, these contradictions suggest that this system is no longer able to continue in the present form. That's why we're seeing all of the signs that suggest that the legitimation process, the symbols of legitimacy, no longer hold like they used to. That's why you have this phenomenon of white folks in the suburbs, white young folks taking a knee, you know, in solidarity, you know, with the young man out in San Francisco, you know, because those kinds of symbols of patriotism are no longer providing the social cement they used to, you know. So these are some serious and interesting times, and you know, the banks and the corporations, they don't really understand what's really going on. That may be a good thing.
Jammu, I first met you when both of us were on the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Michael Ratner was the president. And about that time, Michael and I did a book called The Emerging Police State, and people thought we were a little ultra-left in that formulation on the title. But as it turns out, that really hasn't been the case. And I wanted to ask you, what have you been speaking about with respect to the American government's evolution on torture, spying, keeping Guantanamo open, militarization of local police departments, everything we've seen in the last dozen years?
We place this commitment commitment on the part of the state to utilize its repressive apparatus to undermine democracy and to intimidate people into silence is a reflection of the what we talked about earlier, the fact that the symbols of legitimacy are no longer there. People are raising serious questions. People are, in fact, in opposition. And so the ruling elite, they have concluded that the ideological controls are slipping and that therefore they have to rely more on the repressive apparatus. So surveillance, undermining and infiltrating organizations, using the power of the state to identify and eliminate their opposition is something that they are increasingly falling back on, both in the U.S. and internationally. So this is something that we have to be aware of. Many of us have argued for quite some time that we have to take a more serious look at repression in the U.S., make the proper connection so that people understand what we are, in fact, up against. Because, as you remember, that was one of my arguments constantly at CCR, that we needed to, be aware of the growing repression and try to preempt it to the extent that we can by making people aware of it and putting in place stronger structures to prevent these kinds of developments, including the killing of U.S. citizens.
Ajamu, we know you have to run, but a final question before we say goodbye is, on the campaign trail, have you had any surprise reactions? Have you learned anything that you'd like to share with us?
That's a very good question. I mean, because I'm learning so much. I think that what I've been learning is that there's more of an appetite for radical solutions than they try to let the people understand exist. I've been really pleasantly surprised by the response of young people out there and their willingness to step out there courageously and to do something different. I've been surprised, quite frankly, by the number of people of color who are involved in Green Party politics. Even though I've known about the Green Party, supported Jill Stein and supported Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente back in 2008, I didn't really realize how many people of color, in particular, how many black folks who were really involved in the Green Party at so many different levels. So that's been a big surprise. So I'm really gratified by this experience and really see some real potential with developing this party more past November the 8th. Yeah, that was really the biggest thing for me, biggest couple of things.
Jammu Baraka, we're going to let you go, but I just want to say that this interview that we're conducting now will be broadcast across the country. Up to 100 stations have now picked up Law and Disorder. We want to give a shout out to our newest station in Fairbanks, Alaska. They're going to be hearing you. We wish you every success. You and Jill Stein, wonderful job. Keep it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
More than 10 years ago, four librarians in Connecticut fought back after FBI agents handed them national security letters seeking library records under the Patriot Act and warned them it was a criminal offense to discuss them with anyone. The letters demanded that the librarians identify patrons who had used library computers online at a specific time 1 year earlier. The four librarians challenged the legality of the request in a lawsuit represented by the ACLU. A year later, the government withdrew the demand for information and the gag order. The media dubbed them the Connecticut Four. Recently, the four have reunited to draw attention to attempts by the U.S. Senate to expand the amount and kinds of information that the government may compel libraries and others to divulge. It could force librarians to give the FBI transaction records, such as email metadata, links clicked on to access other websites, and the length and time of internet search sessions. Joining us today to talk about this is George Christian, Executive Director of Library Connection. Welcome, George, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Can you take us back to the incident over 10 years ago where the librarians fought back? And I assume you were one of them.
Yes, I was. I'm the executive director of a consortium of, at that time, 27 libraries in central Connecticut. And we maintain the computer system that controls all of the patron records and all of the library records, and essentially enables the libraries to transact their business, to assign books to particular patrons that borrow them. So we got a call from, in 2005, we got a call from the FBI saying that they were going to serve us with a national security letter. Why they gave us an advance warning, I don't know, but I'm so glad they did. I called our attorney, who works for the University of Connecticut's Law School and does pro bono work for nonprofits, and said, "We're going to get a national security letter. What on earth is that?" And she didn't know, but she had a law student that did some research and found that a national security letter is a subpoena-like instrument that the USA Patriot Act authorizes the FBI to issue for information that it wants, but there's no judicial review. Essentially, the FBI can write its own subpoenas and warrants. And a court in New York had found this violates the First, the Fourth, and the Fifth Amendments and was clearly unconstitutional, but that case was under appeal. So I said, well, that's all I need to know. Thank you. And then I waited 2 weeks for the FBI to show up, and they finally did and had a national security letter. They were very insistent that I read, and they use their finger to follow along, the clause that essentially provides a perpetual gag order. Legally, I couldn't even admit that the FBI had been there to visit us, let alone what they had asked for. But I also noted to my relief that what they were asking for was an incident that had happened 5 months earlier, so I knew that they were not in hot pursuit of anyone, and that if I dug my heels in, I wasn't going to be putting any of my fellow citizens in danger. So I said, well, I understand from my attorney that the authority you're trying to use here is unconstitutional, and I'd just like to check before I comply. And they said, fine, have your attorney call our attorney, and they gave me their card, and they left. So then I called my attorney and said, great, they were here. I told them, you know, we weren't going to obey a national security letter. What do we do now? And that's when I learned that, unfortunately, the only way to contest either the gag order or compliance with the security letter itself was to sue the Attorney General of the United States. That's how I became John Doe, along with the executive committee of my board of directors, who I wanted to be part of the decision, since if this went to a lengthy litigation, we might be using a lot of the firm's money.
The so-called Connecticut Four, as the media dubbed you, consisted of you, that other individual, and who else?
Consisted of me, myself, and three directors of our member libraries who were on the board and who were serving as the executive committee of the board. They were Peter Chase from the Plainville Library, Barbara Bailey from the Glastonbury Library, and Jan Nocek from the Portland Library.
And then did you reach out to the ACLU to represent you?
Actually, our attorney did that for us. She said, you know, geez, I'd love to fight the good fight with you, but my mandate doesn't extend to suing the Attorney General, so I'll see who I can find.
Right.
She turned out that the ACLU was looking for a case like this, and they were eager to help us, and we were eager to have their assistance.
At the time, did you know that very few people had challenged NSLs, or national security letters?
Well, at the time, we knew that there was at least one other case, because it had, you know, that's how the court case was found by the law student. But what we didn't know was the context. We didn't know that at the time, hundreds of thousands of these letters had been issued, and everybody complied. And in a way, I can understand. I mean, when these two gentlemen from the FBI showed up, they had really large badges that were gold and shiny. And, you know, in the back of my mind was this small voice saying, hey, it's the FBI, give them a hand.
Interesting.
But, you know, since I knew that their authority was unconstitutional, and especially when I knew they weren't in hot pursuit of someone, I felt that it was my duty as a citizen to say, no, you can't do this.
Was the material they were requesting the kinds of books that an individual had taken out, or was it transactional history?
Actually, what they wanted to know was anything we could tell them about who was using a certain IP address that we owned for a 15-minute period back in February. And even at the time, I told them, you know, that, hey, this could turn out to be my staff. It could be a library that we've assigned this to. But if it's a library, it goes to a router. And routers, not to foil the FBI, but just to make it difficult for hackers, they randomly assign a set of IP addresses to all of the devices behind them, so that, you know, 6 months later, you don't have a prayer of figuring out which device we're talking about, let alone who was using it. And they said, oh, don't worry about it, we have ways. And I'm thinking to myself, this is from an agency that's afraid to use email at the time. But anyway, it was a moot point because we weren't going to disclose where that IP address led to. Our fear was that we knew it was the IP address of a library, but if we identified the library, we knew that we couldn't, neither we nor the library could go any further, and that if the FBI was determined, the next thing they would do is say, all right, now we need the names and addresses of everybody who's a registered patron at that library. So we would be involving thousands of citizens, casting them into this net of suspicion, and really there was no way to even presume that whoever was using the computer at the library was a registered patron. They might have just walked in the door and used the free public access terminal. We needed better evidence than what the FBI was giving us.
What do you find offensive about this with respect to constitutional rights?
I find two things. I find, one, the FBI can determine what people must disclose without any judicial review that indicates there's a reasonable cause. And we maintained all along, you know, just give us a court document and we'll help you. We certainly don't have a mandate nor a desire to protect lawbreakers. The other thing that really I objected to was this whole veil of secrecy. You know, if I'm given a subpoena, and we do get them from time to time from local police, but it's a court order and we're happy to comply. But I'm free to say that, hey, we got a court order asking for this kind of information. You know, that it's public knowledge that this is what the police are doing. They're not operating in secret. But except for the fact that we won our lawsuit, I would have to go to my grave with the secret knowledge that the FBI had been to us and was looking for information, or that we had given it to them. Everybody else of the hundreds of thousands of recipients of national security letters is in the same dilemma. They're going to their graves with this secret, because now it's like there's a 5-year penalty assigned to violating the secrecy.
George, a while back we interviewed Allison Macrina from the Library Freedom Project about how they helped install Tor at Kilton Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, to protect the anonymity of their patrons who use their computers. Would Connecticut libraries consider something like this?
I'm sure some of them have been or are considering, but our consortium really runs the computer system. We don't set policies or even suggest policies to individual libraries. So you'd really have to talk with a group of library directors for a better answer on that. I will say, though, that to my knowledge, I haven't heard that any Connecticut libraries have adopted Tor, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't happened.
Can you talk to us about the legislation that was barely defeated this summer, the amendment to a Department of Justice spending bill that would give the FBI even more power to collect data with national security letters?
Yes, there's a section of the USA Patriot Act called Section 215, and it gives or can give the FBI really broad powers to collect wholesale all kinds of electronic information. Normally, even when they're issuing a national security letter, in their own minds, there must be a link between the person or persons they are interested in and a potential terrorist act or crime. But with the Section 215, they're just going to go gather a large group of records and then have the freedom to examine them and see if it leads anywhere. So that's really a frightening kind of power. It's called the library provision because it would be used in institutions like libraries to force the library to reveal everyone who was on a computer or maybe even set up devices that would passively track all the usage of computers at libraries. And libraries all are about freedom of access to information. It's really a horrible idea.
And precisely for that reason, librarians themselves are in the position, really, of being gatekeepers of privacy. Are librarians across the country concerned about this and perhaps rallying against it?
Yes, they are. In all of our states, 48 of our 50 states have specific statutes, and the two that don't have administrative rules that not only classify library records as privileged information, but require libraries to take active steps to make sure that this information is not released without court orders or without the patron's specific permission that it be released. So yes, within the ALA, there's a lot of chatter going on. People are really up in arms that this provision is being thought of as being reintroduced and renewed.
George, I imagine that you have George Orwell's book 1984 on the shelf of your library. And if you were to take it off the shelf and look through it, how do you think it's relevant to what's happened with the Patriot Act, what's happened to this country and the state of fear that we've been living in ever since 9/11?
Yeah, well, I have to admit it's been a couple of decades since I read 1984, and I'm fuzzy on the specifics. But the whole idea of Big Brother, you know, that the government knows what's best for us, and the government will look out for us, and the government will make sure that we're exercising good judgment and doing the right thing. That's just an anathema to the way this country operates and the way we were founded on. We're founded on the idea of limiting government and limiting its ability to intrude on the lives of citizens. The whole point of the Constitution is to protect citizens from their own government. The intrusions of the Patriot Act are really antithetical to that.
George, we all remember, I guess, right after the Patriot Act was initially passed, I think some libraries creatively put up signs saying the Department of Homeland Security has not visited the library today for the very reason that they weren't allowed to talk about whether they'd gotten a national security letter or something else.
And the sign said below them, watch for the removal of this sign.
Right. Yeah, we really love librarians for their creativity and their diligence to protecting our freedoms. How can our listeners find out more or get involved to fight this possibly reintroduced new legislation?
Well, I think the first thing they would do, if I were them, I would Google Section 215 of the Patriot Act so they really understand what it's about. And there are links not only to legislation and the gist of the legislation, but there are also links to attempts to have this authority renewed. And once they know what they're talking about in specific, I would encourage them to write their congressman and let their congressman know that they are aware that this legislation is sunsetting and there are attempts afoot to renew it, and that they really don't want that to happen, that we need the constitutional protections of the judiciary saying that there is probable cause before things like subpoenas or warrants are issued. That's what I would recommend. And, you know, the one lesson I learned from this is that our civil liberties are not guaranteed by the Constitution. Our civil liberties are guaranteed by our willingness to insist that the provisions of the Constitution be honored. And that's what we all have to do.
Before we say goodbye, I just want to ask, when those FBI agents visited, you said there was sort of a moment's hesitation where you thought it might be the right thing to comply. Were you afraid after they came?
No, I wasn't. And because it was actually, it was almost funny. Of the two FBI agencies, there was a very nicely dressed young man in blazer and pants, sort of the way I dress professionally. But he was a diminutive in stature, and I don't mean to say that in any pejorative way at all. He was just not a big man. But his partner was this extremely robust individual who was wearing a spandex shirt, so there was just no doubt how robust he was. And the thought that went through my head was, you know, good cop, bad cop. So at that time, I was more amused than afraid. And fortunately, it was only after we were well into this that the ACLU attorneys admitted to us that, based on their experience with the first case, they were very afraid because the FBI went out of their way to intimidate them with the first case. But we did not experience that.
Well, congratulations on your previous victory, which really, I think, shows us the courage of librarians and the importance of having you on the front lines.
You know, I think that in the future, when you're waiting to get on an airplane and they announce that people in the service are entitled to priority boarding, we should say librarians should get on the airplane first.
Agree.
Well, you're absolutely I don't mean that I take the humor in what you're saying, but when I was on the lecture circuit right after this incident became public and I was free to talk, the point I would make is that when you join the armed forces of the United States, you take a very simple oath. You do not promise to defend the flag. You do not promise to defend the country. All you do is promise to defend the Constitution of the United States. And if you're an enlisted person, you say that you will also obey orders of the commander-in-chief. But if you're an officer, there's no such qualification. You are just unreservedly swearing that you will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States to the best of your ability. So, you know, I always said that in this battle with the Patriot Act, I feel I'm the patriot. You're absolutely right.
A real patriot. Thank you, George.
A pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Just before 5 in the morning on April 27th, 700 law enforcement officers conducted the largest gang raid in New York history in the Williamsbridge section of the North Bronx. Prosecutors used the 1970 law, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, and 78 young men, averaging 24 years in age, were arrested and indicted on conspiracy charges. All are being charged collectively for 8 murders and firearms and drug charges dating back 2 decades. In one apartment, more than a dozen police threw flashbang grenades and broke down the front door with assault weapons aimed at Paula Clark and her 2 young daughters, then forced them to crawl down their hall on all fours toward the officers. At a press conference, police characterized the young men as, quote, the epitome of organized crime today. Cooperating federal agencies included the DEA, the ATF, the U.S. Attorney General, and ICE's Homeland Security investigations. Community members questioned this portrayal, saying that the young men were not highly organized gangsters terrorizing a community. They lacked money and weapons and were all living at home with their parents. Critics also claim that applying RICO to street gangs has racist implications. And under RICO, individuals can easily be found guilty by association. Despite gang-related crime in New York City accounting for less than 2% of citywide crime, 2 weeks after the raid, James O'Neill, now the NYPD commissioner, promised 20 more raids before July 4th. And the department quadrupled its gang division by launching Operation Crew Cut in 2012. 2 years later, 2014 Initiative has spent over $64.6 million on surveillance cameras and has singled out 15 projects as high-crime zones. At least 10 of those housing projects have experienced police raids. Here to discuss the case, now known as the Bronx 120, is Cindy Gorn. Cindy is a member of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Cindy Gorn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me on right now.
What is your relationship to the so-called Bronx 120?
The Bronx 120 is a group of 120 people, mostly but not all young black men, who were indicted in two different cases under what's called RICO charges in April of 2016 in the East Chester Gardens housing project and surrounding areas in Williamsbridge area of New York in the Bronx. And my relationship is that I'm a member of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is a organization that fights incarceration, the prison system, and policing. And we reached out to family members after the raids had happened, and since then have been building relationships both with family members who have been affected as well as directly with inmates through writing letters and corresponding via letters and phone calls to people inside as well.
Now, a lot of people in New York City haven't heard much more than a brief news announcement about this back in April. What is unusual about this raid, and what kind of evidence existed to warrant these arrests?
Sure, that's an excellent question. There's many things that are unusual about the raids, and unfortunately, there's a lot that's becoming very usual about them. Perhaps what's most unusual is that there were seven different agencies involved and over 700 different law enforcement officials who were involved on the ground in the raid. And it wasn't just an NYPD raid, as we've seen all over the city. Probably most people remember the Grant and Manhattanville raids in Harlem in 2014, where 90 young people were picked up and initially incarcerated. This, on the other hand, involved also federal agencies, including Homeland Security and the FBI. What's also unusual is the scale. This is the largest raid that New York City has ever seen. What is perhaps usual about it is that these raids are the new wave of policing that the NYPD has decided to use in poor black neighborhoods. And in terms of the evidence, unfortunately, the way that these raids have been rolled out is in a way counterposed to stop and frisk, which I'm sure most people know about and most listeners know about, the practice of at random or sometimes through intentional harassment, stopping people, especially poor black and Latino people, in the neighborhoods where they live and charging them on a variety of small to medium charges they may or may not be convicted of, but nonetheless stay in their record. So a lot of these charges that people may have gotten during the era of stop and frisk are actually being used as evidence in this current case. So RICO, unlike a regular criminal conviction, is based on the notion of association. So if a crime has been committed, someone can be held responsible for that crime without ever having to be proven that they had anything directly to do with it. So this set of legislation was initially introduced to intervene in mafia activity so that mafia bosses who are handing commands down to people who are doing robberies and murders would be held responsible. Now, this type of logic that you don't have to be directly involved in the crime, you just have to know someone who was, is being used against these young people. And of course, these young people know one another. Most of them went to elementary school together. They live in the same housing project. So it's not hard to show that they have association or that they know one another. And furthermore, many of these people have, if not been convicted of some low-level criminal offense, have been charged with it simply because of the high level of policing. And now those former charges are actually being used as evidence that these people have been involved in some kind of quote-unquote gang-related activity.
It's almost as though they're arresting an entire community.
It's exactly like that, yes. I mean, you have to imagine what happens when an entire generation of young people have been picked up, you know, in one raid. And not to mention that many of these young people have been targeted by police before, and unfortunately, even people who were not targeted in this raid may have been targeted by police at other times. I'm sure anyone who lives in New York, whether you live in public housing or not, has witnessed the type of policing that occurs in these housing projects. There's bright lights shown. We can think about the example of a Kigurley. We know that they are in the hallways. Oftentimes, police have guns drawn, going in and out of people's private residences with the full recognition and allowance of public housing authority for people to be policed. And yes, I think it is exactly as you said. It's exactly as if an entire generation has been destroyed in this way.
Can you tell us how the families have been affected by these raids?
Of course. The families have been affected very severely by these raids. I just got off the phone with one mother who was in tears talking to me because her son has been particularly targeted while he's in prison. She believes, and for good reason, that it's targeted because she's one particular mother who has spoken out a lot. And what she just told me on the phone was that another mother told her that her son, who's located near a woman's son in the facility, saw him being shot with rubber bullets while he was in his cell, that in the past, witnesses have seen him tear gas in his cell. So you can only imagine the kind of weight that this draws on a mother, especially this person and others have been denied visitation for their sons. In addition to the type of abuse that people are facing in prison, there's another horrible side to these raids, which is called the NYCHA exclusionary housing laws. And so what this means is that if you have someone in your household who has been convicted of a crime, you have, in order to stay in your housing, you might be forced to sign something saying they're no longer allowed on your property. And so, of course, this is puts mothers in a very, very difficult situation. If they have a family member that they need to support, who's been convicted of something, for example, some kind of low-level drug charge. It doesn't even have to be anything high-level. It could be something as simple as possession of marijuana, which obviously white kids all over the city are possessing marijuana all the time and aren't forced to stay out of their homes. So mothers might be forced to sign this kind of document. And in this raid, some of these children were found on their family's property. And so now we're looking at families who are facing eviction from housing that they've been in for upwards of 20 years, all as a result of this raid.
Cindy, it's interesting because a lot or some public housing buildings, at least in the neighborhood I live in, are being privatized. And I wonder if this is part of an effort to start moving people out of the projects.
I think there's absolutely no question that this is a motivation, or at least appears to be a motivation, of the raid. Evictions that have been happening, the press around individuals and family members has been largely very negative, saying, look, we cleaned up the neighborhood, we got these criminals off the streets. Williamsbridge neighborhood is easily accessible by train. It's very beautiful, in part because residents there have kept it very beautiful. It's very vibrant, and people who live there have definitely said that they've already seen signs of gentrification. So we'll see what exactly the plans are for East Chester Gardens, but I think that it's fairly certain to say that these raids are a part of gentrification.
What kind of legal defense are these young men, and I assume they're mostly men, getting?
That's correct. They are mostly men. There are women involved as well, and they're also not being treated well in prison. In terms of the type of legal defense, everyone is being represented in individual cases, and many of these families and many of these young people, the majority of them, in fact, are not able to afford private lawyers, which, again, it's a little bit absurd to think about this RICO that was created to prosecute high-level mafia bosses now is being used against people who live in public housing, are on food stamps, and can't even afford their own private lawyers. So many of these young people have federally appointed attorneys. The city, there are also people who have local public defenders from a variety of different legal aid and public defender organizations, but they ran out of attorneys in some short amount of time. So there's also federally appointed public attorneys. And my understanding is that the family members have had some mixed experiences. Regardless of the lawyers, it's safe to say that the judge and prosecution has been pushing people very, very hard to take plea deals of anywhere between 8 to 22 years in an incredibly short amount of time. And now I have not met any of these lawyers, and I can't speak to them. I'm sure a lot of them are fighting very hard for the families. But it's a quite extreme situation that in some families, some young people in 2 months were pushed to plead out. So it's definitely, again, I'm sure there's a large variety of legal representation, and that there's many lawyers who are fighting very, very hard for their clients. But the situation is such that it's a very tense legal situation.
Now, what kind of organizing, if any, exists among the families and this local community in terms of raising visibility of this?
That's an excellent question. There has been organizing since pretty much the first day after the raid around this. Some of the first events organized by family and community members were press conferences, also going to the local city council members' meetings and trying to understand and in some cases argue against what they were saying about people who were in the raids when they were saying negative things about family members and the youth. Since then, there's been a variety of work done by the family members. Family members have produced and created, with the help of Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and with the help of many others as well, produced pamphlets and flyers, gone door to door, trying to talk with other family members. Recently, we organized a pack the court to get people to the recent court dates last Wednesday and Thursday, the 19th and 20th, and as well as a speak out for family members at those court dates.
We're speaking with Cindy Gorn. She's a member of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Cindy, how widespread, really, is gang violence in New York City?
That's a really excellent question. I think it's really difficult to say. I think that we definitely can't believe the hype that the NYPD and the press associated with the NYPD, like the New York Post, puts out about quote-unquote gang violence. There is obviously violence associated with drugs and with weapons in the city, and unfortunately it does at times affect people who are some of the most exploited, people who come from working class and poor families. In New York, there doesn't tend to be the type of large organizations that have existed in the past and still exist in some places. And when there is violence, it does tend to be among smaller groups of people as opposed to some type of large-scale, you know, international mafia-type organization. But again, I think that we can't trust what the NYPD and what the media says about quote-unquote gang violence, because they have a very particular agenda behind them, which is obviously increasing policing. I'm sure people have also heard at this point that there has been a lot of surveillance through social media. So if someone puts a certain kind of picture of themselves up and someone else likes it, the person who likes it can be charged with being in association, in formal association with that person, and therefore in a gang.
Cindy, that's an astonishing observation.
It really is, and I think that they're able to do this because a lot of the audience that they're appealing to does tend to be people who are not from these communities and does tend to be people who might already have a very negative view of Black people and a very negative view of people living in public housing without having any experience in these communities at all. And I think it's very safe to say that these sources, and as well as the NYPD, and as well as, unfortunately, many members of the city council, do not always have the best interest of the actual people that they're discussing in mind. They tend to talk about people as if they're objects for others to be afraid of, as opposed to actually being involved in the real communities.
Cindy, unfortunately, we're getting to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you one last question with respect to the Bronx 120. Does this case have national implications?
That's an excellent question. I do believe it has national implications, and I do believe that these strategies, from what I've heard, have been being studied by police departments all over the country, in Chicago and in Boston at the very least. And as we all know, the NYPD tends to be the vanguard of policing activity, not just for the country, but the world. I've heard that the Israeli army also studies from the NYPD, and they share information about how best to exploit and oppress people. So it certainly has national as well as international implications. And without fighting this, we show that this is allowed and that we permit this. I think it's very, very crucial that everyone, not just in New York, takes a strong stand against these types of measures.
Cindy, in that vein, how can our listeners learn more and possibly get involved in this case?
That's a great question. People can email IWOC at iwoc.nyc@riseup.net. And people can also find us on Facebook. You can look for Bronx 120. And you can also look for Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, NYC. Both of those ways are great ways to find out more information about what's going on and also to get involved. We do have a letter writing coming up this Saturday, and if people want to know more, they can contact us through any of those means, and we'll be more than happy to connect you to the struggle.
Cindy Gorn, thank you so much for not only your involvement in this important case, but joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, thank you both so much for covering this. It's so crucial, and we really need the support, and it means a lot that people like you are willing to reach out and have this on your show. So thank you.
Yeah, take good care. Luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.